You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
What is Scientology? Well, to some, including the IRS, it's a religion. To others, it's a cult. Lawrence Wright's latest book, Getting Clear, describes it as having a philosophy that combines the vision of Star Trek, the disciplinary measures of Captain Bly, and the glamour of Hollywood. Why this odd cocktail has appealed to so many is a question that's often asked, and Lawrence Wright asked that question to former church members, including Paul Haggis, the successful screenwriter responsible for Crash and Million Dollar Baby. And he was also a Scientology member for 35 years. Mr. Wright was a guest on the show in January to discuss his book, and we thought we would re-air it for you today. I began by asking Lawrence Wright, isn't the church notorious for coming after journalists who write bad things about it? Were you at all nervous about writing this book?
I was open-eyed, let's say. I was aware of the dangers.
Because you'd heard the Paulette Cooper story, hadn't you?
Yeah, that was a horrible story. You know, they persecuted her. They tried to frame her, saying that she had issued bomb threats to the president and bomb threats to the church, and they got her indicted. And fortunately, in 1977, when the FBI did a raid of the church's files, they found a file titled Operation Freakout, in which they talked about trying to get her incarcerated in jail or a mental institution.
And they also went after Time magazine.
Yeah, that was a 1991 expose by Richard Bayer, an investigative journalist. And, you know, they put private investigators on him. They got his phone records. They tracked him down, you know, harassed him. And they sued Time magazine. They lost at every step along the way, all the way to the Supreme Court. But it was the most expensive suit that Time has ever defended.
And the church has the advantage of having members who are lawyers who are willing to work for free. It's used lawsuits very successfully over the years. Didn't L. Ron Hubbard give instructions about the use of lawsuits?
Oh, yeah. You know, the object is not necessarily to win. It's to harass your critics. And so, and his instructions are scriptural inside the church. So one can look at his advice and know what's coming.
Scriptural to the point where people smoke cigarettes because he smoked cigarettes.
Well, that's not really a part of the scripture. He didn't write down that it was a
good thing. I'm just saying that they follow him as...
Indeed. It's one of the nice, curious features of Scientology is that there are certain archaic 1950s habits of speech and you know, also a lot of cigarette smoking and so on, attitudes towards women and so on that you see buried in the culture of the church and attitudes towards homosexuals too, which is one of the tripping points for the church.
Your English publisher decided not to publish the book, but they say it has nothing to do with the church's reaction. Do you believe that? Aren't the libel laws a lot looser in Britain?
The libel laws are completely different from our country. They don't have the First Amendment. Actually, Penn, the International Writers Association, has asked me to go to Britain and talk to members of Parliament and the Minister of Justice about the deficiencies in their laws, which prevent information from being circulated about organizations that might have quite a lot to hide.
On the other hand, Germany probably would be happy to publish this book in translation. Haven't they banned the Church of Scientology?
Yeah, on occasion they have, and it's very hard for Scientologists to operate there, and we have sold our book in Germany.
Now, should I be worried?
You should always be concerned, Leonard. I would imagine for more than one reason.
Now, didn't this book begin as a profile that you wrote for The New Yorker about Paul Haggis? He is a successful screenwriter and director. And how did you wind up even hearing that story?
I'd heard that he had dropped out of the church. I was engaged in some other project at the time. I was finishing up some more of my Al-Qaeda work. But I was always interested in Scientology. I've written about a number of religions in my career, but Scientology was such a curiosity to me, and I wondered why people would be drawn into it, and especially notable celebrities, and what do they get out of it? But I didn't have the central figure that I would want to have to carry me and the reader into that world until Paul dropped out.
You call him a donkey. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not a disparaging term. A donkey is a beast of burden. if you're going to write about something that's as obscure and complicated as the Church of Scientology, you have to give the reader a reason to care. And that central figure that I call the donkey is that figure who can carry the reader into this esoteric world. And everything that pertains, if you care about this person, the information that he carries becomes that much more interesting and vital to the reader. So if you have that donkey, then you have a way to get into that world.
Now, the New Yorker is famous for its fact checkers. What happened when you wrote that article?
Well, I had asked to talk to Scientology executives, and I was invited to go out to California, and the Tommy Davis, who was the chief spokesperson at the time, said he was going to take me through Scientology. He wanted to have enough time to do that, so we were going to do it over Labor Day weekend. So I flew out to L.A., spent Friday night, Saturday night. Finally, Sunday at 3 p.m., he comes to tell me that he's not going to do that. And he just said, I just wanted to tell you face-to-face. And, well, thanks a lot. I flew all the way out here, and I'm not going to get to see it.
Well, wasn't that the point?
It may have been, but I really do think he was instructed not to talk to me. But he did agree that he would respond to fact-checking queries. I don't know if he really understood what that meant in the New Yorker context.
Well, Tommy Davis is no longer the spokesperson for Scientology.
Right.
Do you think that's related to this incident?
It might be.
Was Paul Haggis a typical Scientologist or a typical Hollywood Scientologist?
Well, he's an unusual person. It'd be hard to call him typical of anything, but he was very much a part of the Scientology community. His wife was deeply engaged in the community. His children went to Scientology-based schools. He gave tons of money to the church. He had, you know, fundraisers at his home. So, yes, he was very much involved in that society.
And partly because he was learning to be a screenwriter, and he met somebody who introduced him to the church?
When he was a young man in Ontario, in a little town called London, Ontario, he was walking down the street, and some guy sold him a copy of Dianetics, the L. Ron Hubbard bestseller, and that intrigued him, and he went to the Church of Scientology, and from there he went on to L.A.
And Dianetics was the entry for many people. Initially, it seemed to be more present itself more as an alternative to traditional psychology.
Right.
When was the science fiction aspect of the story introduced? Was it there from the start? Was I just unaware of it?
Yeah, after Dianetics, Hubbard decided to start a church. He lost control of the movement of Dianetics, which was this vast self-help thing that swept the country. It was hugely popular. Excuse me?
How did it work?
Oh, the idea was that you could treat yourself, and you don't need to go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist. You need to, you may use a friend, but you would uncover these memories that were in your mind that were controlling your behavior. And once you recognize them and you delete their power, then you're free to act in a more rational way.
Although you were holding on to some soup cans, empty soup
cans.
Yes,
this came along with Scientology. This was called the E-meter. And they originally were Campbell's soup cans with the label scraped off and wires connecting it to a meter, and there was a small current. This is actually one-third of a lie detector. It didn't measure your pulse or respiration, but it did measure your galvanic skin responses. So if you can imagine being in therapy with a lie detector, you can envision that, you know, it had it could be very potent. It could also be very misleading. In auditing, sometimes people are led to believe in past lives, for instance. They may think, they may have an image that comes into their mind. And the auditor would say, there's something there. The meter is telling me there is something there. So if, you know, you look around, you think that you're in southern France in the 17th century, then you walk down the street, and the E-meter helps you believe that this is a real memory. And so you validate this. And, of course, you want to believe that you've lived before, because if you have, that means you'll live again, that you're immortal. And this is thrilling.
And didn't L. Ron Hubbard claim that he had lived at the time of Machiavelli, in fact, knew Machiavelli.
Yeah, he blamed him for stealing his best line, which is the end justifies the means.
Now, what you just said a little while ago was that he lost control of Dianetics, so he created Scientology so he could make some money from this whole thing?
Well, he said a number of occasions that that's where the money is. On the other hand, I don't really think of him as a fraud or a con man, as many others do, because if he really were that figure, at some point he would have taken the money and run, and he had a lot of money, made a ton of money on this. But he did not do that. He spent his whole life elaborating this cosmology and the bureaucracy that supports it.
Well, where did he say this cosmology came from? Because in effect, he's presenting himself as a prophet.
Yeah, he never,
somebody who is in tune with something that nobody else in the world is in tune with.
He never disclosed where these revelations appeared. He said, let's not get into that.
No gold plates or anything like that?
No, he said, let's not get into that. And people took him at his word. And bear in mind, they were also, you know, oftentimes these young acolytes were going through auditing and they were discovering their own past life experiences. And so it tended to verify the authenticity of his.
My guess is Lawrence Wright. His latest book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief, follow-up to his Pulitzer Prize-winning Look at Al-Qaeda, now a major motion picture. No, that's a different telling of the story. What happened with Paul Haggis? When did he start becoming disillusioned?
Well, he began to put a little distance in his relationship to the church, after he had gone to the very peak of the Scientology spiritual pyramid. He didn't get what he thought he was told he was going to get out of it.
Well, you keep on, as I understand it, you start at the bottom and then little by little, at a great cost, unless you're one of the big celebrities, mm-hmm. You keep on being moved up to a higher and higher level. He moved up to OT
Seven,
which is the highest level.
At the time, it is an OT8 now, but at the time that he was in the church, he went all the way to the top.
And aren't those the things that you learn meant to be kept secret?
Well, yes. You know, now all this is out on the internet and it's ridiculed on South Park and so on. But at the time that Paul did it, these secrets were, you know, unknown to, except for the elect, those who had already paid and gone through those courses. Nobody really knew the inner secrets.
Well, if it were up to OT8, that means that new stories are being added. L. Ron Hubbard is not around. Who's coming up with them?
They say that these were, post-mortem, that he had left this behind. They actually say that they're up to OT15, but we've never seen any of these later OT levels.
Isaac Hayes played the chef on South Park, and he quit after they did the episode about Scientology, in which they depicted the Scientology creation story and had words underneath it saying something like, this is the real...
This is what they really believe.
This is what they really believe.
Yeah, that was, and Tom Cruise protested and kept it from being rebroadcast. So there was a lot of pressure brought to bear.
We will take a little break and come back with more about Scientology with Lawrence Wright, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Looming Tower. His latest book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. It's published by Knopf. We're back with Lawrence Wright, whose book, The Looming Tower, won the Pulitzer Prize some years back. He was on our show in January to talk about his latest work called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. It elicited a large response from our listeners, so we thought we would play it for you again today. I started off the second part of our conversation by mentioning the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, and I asked Lawrence Wright, wasn't he a successful science fiction writer?
Oh, very much so. He was a part of a circle the pulp writers here in New York was the center of this. And Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, people like that were all a part of his circle. And he was president of the Science Fiction Club and so on.
So when did he discover Dianetics, which changed his life?
He wrote this book in the early months of 1950, actually in the space of 1 month. And he wrote a letter to his friend Heinlein saying, you know, it started in the middle of January, finished in the middle of February, and is published a few months later. It was written at breakneck speed. He wrote 100,000 words a month, according to legend. And he would put in a roll of butcher paper into his typewriter, Platen, and it was a physical action. He would perspire because he was working so quickly. And then when he finished, he would take a T-square and cut it off and send the story off to the publisher. So as a writer, I have to say, you know, this is a man who holds the record for the number of titles, book titles, more than 1,000.
Wow. One of the founding claims about Scientology, one of its founding miracles, was that he used Dianetics to cure himself from battle wounds and to restore his vision because he'd been blinded in battle.
Yeah, that's part of the church's narrative and Hubbard's own narrative about himself. The military and medical records don't support that.
You requested proof from the church. How did they... did they try to authenticate the claims?
Yeah, they did. They produced... two things for me. One was what purported to be this this discharge paper, which listed a number of medals that he had won, some of them foreign and so on. And they also had a photograph of the medals they say he won, which didn't really correspond to the ones that were listed in his discharge, but a considerable number of heroic medals. And then we went to the military archives in St. Louis and got all of his military records and also the actual discharge that corresponded to the one that the church gave us. They're completely different. And the military historians in St. Louis say that the one that the church produced is a forgery.
You relied on something you called Hubbard's secret memoir.
Yeah.
What's that?
After the war, he'd had some real mental difficulty. He had written to the Veterans Administration asking for some psychiatric help, and
probably had PTSD.
He could well have, but he didn't really see much action. You know, he had an undistinguished war record, and but he was still very unsettled by his behavior during the war, and he began to record these things called affirmations, and they were interesting reading because you can see that, you know, he admits that his war service was none too glorious. He's got a number of fears that he says he's trying to overcome, that he says, you know, you are attractive to look at. You know, you're irresistible to women. He says there are no snakes in the bottom of your bed. Obviously, he's got a lot of phobias and fears that he's struggling with himself. And this is, I think, the prelude to his decision to write Dianetics. It was a form of self-therapy.
Well, he could have gone into regular therapy. Does Dianetics overlap Freudian theories?
Oh, I think it borrows from it extensively. When he was a young man, he was traveling to through the Panama Canal, and he met this naval commander named Snake Thompson. This is a real person. A lot of people doubted his existence, but we really looked into him, who was an acquaintance of Freud and had studied with him. And according to Hubbard, when he was not even a teenager, this man taught him Freudian techniques.
Although now Scientology is very, very hostile to all forms of traditional psychotherapy, psychology, psychoanalysis.
That's right, and I think that goes back to the publication of Dianetics. Hubbard desperately wanted the approval of the American Psychiatric Association and American Psychological Association. He sent them the manuscript asking for their, you know, imprimatur. And for them, it was like psychological folk art. They couldn't make head or tails of it. There were no studies that this was based on. It was all dreamed up in Hubbard's head. And so it was greeted with ridicule, and he never forgot that. And after that, In his worldview, psychiatrists are at the root of all the ills that afflict humanity.
He had a lot of trouble with women as well over the years. How has the Scientology mythology dealt with that? I mean, well, he may have been a bigamist.
He was a bigamist, although they didn't deny it. They say he was only married twice, but we have the marriage certificate for his second wife, Sarah. And also, in the course of researching this book, we came up with a deathbed tape that she made about her marriage to L. Ron Hubbard. It's quite wrenching and very, very telling.
The Scientology story involves thetans. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Thetans are a fundamental part of Scientology cosmology.
When did this come into the story? Right after Dianetics?
Yeah, it was fundamental to his thinking from the beginning that you're an immortal soul. And we call this entity a thetan. Gradually, as he began to elaborate his vision, he began to envision that there are other kinds of thetans. They were really kind of space aliens that infest your body. He called those body thetans. And part of the object of Scientology is to go on the e-meter and in some sensory way find them, cast them out like demons, and that way purge yourself of their influence.
And that leads to your title here, Going Clear.
Right.
You clear yourself.
You clear yourself of any kind of reactive, in neuroses and fears and so on. They're in what Hubbard called your reactive mind.
And the story as it develops sounds more and more like a science fiction novel, the sort of thing that he made a living from writing. Now, a lot of people like fantasy and science fiction, mm-hmm. but it's a big difference between liking reading that kind of stuff and committing yourself to a church promotes it. And many people wonder why obviously intelligent people commit themselves to a story that sounds so outrageous.
Bear in mind, that's not what they're committing to when they first go in the door. You know, if you're going down to the Port Authority and you see a table on the side of the subway with some people offering you a stress test or a personality test, they will say to you, you might have a little problem here. We notice that, you have a problem in your ability to relate to others. We can help you. We have a course. And so what you're really doing when you walk in the door the first time is trying to get some help. This is common for so many people that really go on to become Scientologists.
My guest is Lawrence Wright. His book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So when did it become a church? Most churches are based on some kind of a spiritual theory. Most of them have a Godhead. Scientology seems to be quite different than that.
Yeah, it doesn't really bill itself as a faith. It's more of what they think of as a technology. And in other words, you can go step by step in a guaranteed ascension to spiritual power. And there's a place for God, but not a very big one. It's when they were seeking a tax exemption as a religious organization, they began this kind of religious cloaking. They developed a cross, and ministers started wearing Roman collars and that kind of thing, so that it took on the atmosphere of a church without really having the appurtenances of a faith.
So is it clear that they call themselves a church simply because they wanted to have tax-free status with the IRS?
Well, they desperately wanted that. Hubbard decided not to pay his taxes at some point, and they were $1 billion in arrears with the IRS. And they desperately needed that tax-exempt status, which would also grant them the vast protections of the First Amendment. So in 1993, there was a meeting at the IRS headquarters. And bear in mind, the Church of Scientology had launched 2,400 lawsuits against the IRS and individual agents. And completely beleaguered and overwhelmed. It's hard to believe, but, this one small church organization had the IRS all tied up in knots.
And didn't they also plant members in
the
IRS?
Yes, and not just the IRS, the Justice Department and many other agencies of government, newspapers, the FBI. There was a Operation Snow White is what you're referring to. And it was one of the probably the biggest infiltration of American government institutions by any agency ever.
And a deal was worked out.
With the IRS in 1993, Scientology dropped all of its lawsuits and the tax exemption was given. And since then, they've been protected by the First Amendment.
And not just in church matters. Isn't the church allowed to publish science fiction novels and not pay taxes?
That's
on
right.
What they
get from? It's a little puzzling, and their auditing fees are also tax exempt. So if you go to a therapist, you're not allowed to deduct that. But if you go to an auditor at a Scientology church, you can.
A caller who is a former member of the C organization wants to make sure we get to the horrors. Can you tell us about the C organization?
The C Org? The C Org, as they call it, was originally what Hubbard took to the high seas in the mid-60s, fleeing process servers and indictments in different countries. And so he took a lot of young people with him, and they called it the C Org. That group eventually became the clergy of the church. And the church claims 6,000 to 8,000 people in that organization, more likely about 5,000, concentrated in two places. One in Clearwater, Florida, where they maintain their spiritual base, and the other in a compound, 500-acre compound in the desert in Southern California called Gold Base. And that's really the international headquarters of the Sea Org. And many Sea Org members live there. Some of them joined as children. In fact, many of them did. Some were born into it.
And some of them wind up being punished for transgressions.
I talked to 12 people who told me that the leader of the church, David Miscavige, had physically assaulted, beaten them. I talked to 20 people who witnessed it. And others had been confined involuntarily in these re-education camps that the church maintains, sometimes for years on end.
How did David Miscavige become the leader after L. Ron Hubbard died?
He pushed others aside. He was not the designated leader. Pat Broeker was a man that was – Pat and his wife Annie, they were the designated leaders, and he essentially pushed them out of the church.
Most outsiders wonder how they have been able to get so many celebrities to join.
It is puzzling, isn't it? That was my initial interest in this book. It's such a stigmatized religion. I didn't really want to write an expose. Why bother? I wanted to understand what was going on inside this organization and what drew notable personalities like Paul Haggis, but also Cruz and Travolta and Christy Alley and Ann Archer and all those people.
And jazz musicians?
Yes, indeed.
Chick Corea,
yeah. Beck. There are a lot of notable personalities that are involved in it. And I don't think, there was an impression people had that there's a network in Hollywood and Scientology will help advance your career. And certainly Scientology sells itself that way. They go down to Central Casting, which is a real entity, by the way, where, aspiring actors stand in line to be extras, and they pass out brochures saying how to get an agent, how to get ahead, come to the Celebrity Center. But those people who do align themselves with Scientology, it seems to me, actually suffer a kind of public relations martyrdom for their religious beliefs. And they're exploited. They're used as product salesmen. And I think they bear a certain moral responsibility for understanding what's going on inside their organization.
Well, it has led to problems for some, like Tom Cruise.
Yes.
Whose first wife, Mimi Rogers, divorced him, and then Nicole Kidman. Were they both deemed suppressives? The church's term for bad people?
Well, bear in mind that Mimi Rogers and Nicole Kidman are celebrities, and they have a different standard for celebrities than they do for ordinary Scientologists.
Did they become Scientologists?
Yes, yeah. Mimi was a Scientologist before Tom. She introduced him to the church, and her father was a well-known Dianetic counselor. So they were deeply involved in the church, and she's the one that acquainted him with Scientology in the first place.
Another listener wants us to talk about the Rehabilitation Project Force. I guess for people who've left the church, these things are really important.
Oh, you know, there have been so many tears in this story and so much distress and broken families. This RPF is what is known as in Scientology. It actually began on the high seas when Hubbard was captaining this little Scientology armada. And especially with people that were misbehaving and children that were getting out of line on ship, he would put them sometimes in the anchor hold. This is a dank, dangerous place. If the anchor was likely to slip or something like that, one could be ripped to pieces. And sometimes children were kept in there for days or even weeks at a time. Out of that, from that, became this network of RPF camps, re-education camps, where people are sentenced involuntarily for long periods of time, and some of them are the most important people in the church's hierarchy. At the goal base that I mentioned, this goal where the Sea Org has its international headquarters, there is a place that's known as the Hole. It's actually two double-wide trailers that are married together. And at one time, more than 100 of the senior executives were crowded into there. I don't know how many are there now. But these were the very top management of the church, and some were there for years. The president of the church is a nominal post, but still, he's the president of the church. Heber Jentsch had been in there for 7 years.
Didn't Hubbard's son call his father a fraud?
Yes. Yes, he did. He was L. Ron Hubbard, Jr., and, you know, he said that he was making it all up.
Now, just let's get back to Paul Haggis for a moment, because he did leave the church. Others do leave the church, although some really have big problems when they try to leave. He was on the show in 2006 to talk about Crash, and when I asked him about Scientology, he was kind of evasive. Was he already having second doubts at that point?
No, but it came shortly after that with Proposition 8. What really happened to Paul, what propelled him out of the church, he was never going to step aside. I think he was just going to put a little distance. But he was still contributing money, and he still had family members that were involved. One of his sisters had joined the Sea Org. His wife was deeply involved. His children went to Scientology-based schools. So he was very much a part of that community. But when Prop 8 came, that's the California proposition opposing gay marriage, one of the Scientology churches signed a petition supporting that proposition. And Paul has two gay daughters. And he tried to get the church to renounce that position, and they wouldn't do it. So he began his own investigation, which is really very unusual.
But until then, he had gone along with
everything. He had closed his eyes. He shut his ears, as so many people inside that organization do. He's unusual. He's really the only celebrity member of the church that ever actually actively looked into the criticism of the church and then publicly renounced it.
Lawrence Wright's book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief, is published by Knopf. Couldn't get to everything, but it was quite fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.